WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be previewing for you the upcoming production of the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, the latest theatrical production at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. In part two, in something a little more serious, we'll talk about eating disorders among teenage girls with the author of a book called Just a Little Too Thin. But first, we begin with Putnam County Spelling Bee, and let's just hear a little bit of the opening of the show before we introduce our guests.
Please spell syzygy.
S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. Syzygy?
We have a winner!
Thank you! Thank you! Thank you!
At the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, my parents keep on telling me, just being here is winning, although I know it isn't so.
But it's a very nice, very, very nice,
very, very, very nice, very nice beginning.
Our winner here last year, Chip Tolentino, Myth Peretti, and our youngest competitor, Logan Schwartz and Grubinier.
At the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Game, I'll stand when they announce my name.
Leaf Coney Bear.
And try and keep from shaking.
A laugh, if shaking will not pass.
Cause it's a very big, very fraught, simple, but it's not. It's a very big undertaking.
Returning after last season's tragic setback, William Barfy.
It's pronounced Barfay. There's an accent ago.
I'm not sure who this girl is.
A few of the opening measures of this delightful musical, which is opening this weekend and running for the next two weekends at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. With me in the studio this morning for part one of today's program is Jennifer Sassaman, Assistant Professor of Theater at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and Nick Berudian, who is the music director for this production. And we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Good to have you here. Nick, you've been on the morning show before. I'm not sure if it's just once, but I know the one time I remember was when you were back in high school. Do you remember that? Oh, a blank stare.
Yeah.
I guess it meant more to me than to you. It was when you were part of that Science Olympic team at Park High School. And so you and a couple of your two teammates came on before you guys went on to whatever that big next level was, and then afterwards the team came back to talk about the experience, but you weren't there then, but you were there for that first conversation. So welcome back after all these many years. Jennifer Sassaman, tell us about Parkside's choice to do this. Was this your idea to take on this really fun but challenging musical?
Well, I did nominate the show, but it's something that that the rest of the faculty was definitely on board with. And I don't know how unique this is, but at Parkside, we actually include the students in our scene selection. We ask for their input, and this is also something that the student body was really eager to sink their teeth into.
Wow. I actually have not heard of that, but
no,
maybe that happens in other places.
Parkside operates on what we call a company model, so we really try to give the students a lot of ownership over the choices that are made on campus.
Very good. Tell us about your own encounters with this. Is this a musical you already knew very well?
I have wanted to do this show for about 10 years, ever since it opened on Broadway and it sort of came into my hemisphere of awareness. I think it's both very funny and very moving, and I think it's difficult for a show to be successfully both of those things, but I think musically it's challenging and interesting and lovely and fun. There are dance numbers, there are ballads. I think the show as a musical kind of has everything a musical could possibly have.
That's really true. And Nick Brody, and the phone rang one day, and somebody from the University of Wisconsin Parkside was wondering if you would take on duties as the music director. At that point, did you know anything about this show? Had you seen it or heard it or know anything about it?
I had not heard of it or know anything about it. I had to look it up online and, you know, see what I could find out. And fortunately for me, Racine Theater Guild put on this production or this show last summer in July, and so I was able to go. It was before then. I was able to go and see it there, and see how it went.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a show, and musically especially, I think it's a huge challenge to take on. I mean, I think a lot of times when you see things that are just kind of fun and breezy and seemingly spontaneous, that you can get the wrong impression of that the music's just fun, but it's incredibly hard, isn't it?
When I saw this at the Theater Guild, that was one of the first things that struck me. It was really enjoyable, and I along with everybody else in the house laughed our heads off. But from knowing that I would be directing music for this production, I was thinking, how does that work? Like, how do they time the music with that line and the next line? And there are many places where it's pretty complicated.
Right.
But that's part of what makes it fun.
Absolutely. One of my memories of that production, that was the third time I'd seen the show, but one of the things that really struck me was the Theater Guild had just finished Les Mis. So to go from Les Mis to 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, it's like the opposite ends of the spectrum, but both really, really great shows. Jennifer, maybe for someone who has not ever seen this show, why don't you explain to them what this what the story is about?
Absolutely. So the premise of the show is that this is a regional middle school spelling bee. So all of the children that are participating in this are between ages 10 and 13, and they have all won their school spelling bee or their district spelling bee, and they've moved on to the region. And whoever wins this spelling bee is going to go and compete in the national spelling bee. So the stakes are high for the participants. The show was written, it's conceived, the idea is that it is adult actors who are playing 10-year-old or 11-year-old or 12-year-old children. And everybody is wrestling with their own set of problems. These are quirky children. These are not sort of your average Benetton ad children. These are kids who have parents who force them to study all night, or kids who feel like they have to be perfect at everything, or people, you know, it's children who are all wrestling with their own very serious issues. And the play is also quite funny, because part of what happens in every production is there are four volunteers that are that from the audience that perform in the show as additional spellers, and that's always, I think, whenever you involve audience participation, it gets a little wacky, it gets fun. And the spelling, the way the show is structured, the spelling of the words, the definitions, and the sentences that explain the words are all very funny. So we alternate really silly improvisation with very deep exploration of real problems and an honest search for identity that's based in who the child is versus who their parents or who society expects them to be.
Hmm. And it's interesting, when you see the show, I think, at least on the most surface level, you'd never think about it in those terms, that it's in fact that deep a show. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right, it really is. What can you tell us about its origins, how it took shape?
I don't know a great deal about the origins. I know this came out of a company in Western Massachusetts, and it was a group of actors who built this show over some time, and it was so popular that it then moved to Off-Broadway and then Broadway. It was kind of a dark horse. It was nominated, though, for Best Musical and several other Tony Awards. It won a bunch of Tony Awards, and after that, it became a really popular show for theater companies around the country, both educational and sort of smaller regional companies to be producing, because it is it is so delightful, and it gets such a powerful response from the audience. Hmm.
One of the things you were saying before we went on the air is that the book is relatively vague. You said, in fact, something like to the effect that you've never dealt with a musical in which the book was so vague. And I didn't understand it at all what you were saying until you kind of explained it further. Explain to our listeners what you're talking about there.
Well, the way the show is structured, again, we bring four volunteers, and it's not like we force people to get up who don't want to be there. There are alternate spellers who spend the first half hour of the play meeting the audience as they come in and finding out who would like to participate. And so four people are selected, and then as Act One unfolds, those four people have to be eliminated. And at first they're given very easy words, and then they're given progressively harder words so that they will ding out, basically. And
right, we need to clear the stage.
We need the drama of people leaving, but we also don't want to clear the stage of all of the primary spellers who are our main characters who all have a journey to go on. So it sort of adds to the tension. And the script is really vague about where these eliminations need to happen. And it's intriguing to me. It was very surprising to read it and to read a note in the script that says, maybe a volunteer goes out here or not. You know, base it on, use your judgment. And there's other paragraphs that say, at this point, you should probably only have two volunteers. So at some point before that, there should have been an elimination, but you don't know where.
Mm.
It was very important to me to cast an actor, the person who calls the spellers down to the mic and gives them their words and their definitions. It was really important that the person who was running that be someone who was comfortable with improvisation and reading the moment and very flexible and a fast thinker.
Fun.
Actually, the person that we wound up casting in that part is also our set designer.
Oh.
But when I started thinking about who in our company is really good at this, I started thinking about the qualities that Panch would need. That's the character's name, Panch. I kept coming back to the person who already had a great deal of responsibility, who was the set designer. Mm. So I had a conversation with him.
Very good. How is the matter of the exact words handled? I mean, does the book include exactly the words that should be posed to, for instance, these amateur spellers out of the audience, or is that completely up to your discretion? Because my recollection is they're not the same performance to performance.
My answer is sometimes.
Mm.
Sometimes the book is very clear about what word needs to be used, but not all the time. And there's a list of words in the back of the script with their very funny definition and their funny use of a word in a sentence. For example, one of the words that always makes me laugh the hardest is the word dengue. And the definition is a tropical fever characterized by a list of symptoms and then diarrhea. And the sentence, so the spellers are supposed to say, may I have a definition? May I have it in a sentence, please? And the sentence that you get after the definition of dengue is when the doctor asked Billy what his symptoms were for the dengue, he said, it was like there was a race out of my tushy and everybody won. And they're all very, very silly like that. And so
there's too many of those to use them all, and it's up to you to decide which ones you think are the funniest, you and
right,
your cast or whatever.
Right. And we've been getting volunteer spellers in all week to rehearse. I teach a theater appreciation class, a gen ed class, which has, you know, 50 students. And so I offered them extra credit to come in and volunteer. And we had one kid in two nights ago who kept spelling words right. We couldn't eliminate him. He was getting words like theochromosotomata and spelling it correctly.
Whoa.
And we were getting a little worried going through the cards trying to find another word that could get him out.
You might have had an extra cast member without really wanting it. So much fun. Nick Berutian, so you went into this, I mean, you agreed to the responsibility relatively blindly. That is not knowing the complexity of the score, and then you went, of course, and saw it. In reality, how has it played out in terms of actually teaching this challenging score to your young cast?
There have been a lot of moments when I thought it was much simpler than it really is. As we're learning, as I'm teaching the music to the actors, and as we're learning it together, there there are songs assigned to one character, like in any musical. You'd find one character plops down and sings from the depths of their heart for a moment, and time stops, mm-hmm. and we get a glimpse of them. But there's really only a couple of those that happen in real isolation. All of the larger numbers are involve not only the ensemble, but the ensemble in various arrangements. Soloists who chime in for a phrase or four words, and they're an essential four words for the next person who sings another four words. And so rehearsing has been tricky to arrange, just because we kind of need everybody there a lot, even though each person is doing relatively little in that scene or in that song.
So the participation is really spread through everybody through many of the songs.
Yeah.
This is a purely ensemble piece. And often with a musical, the music director might be working with one person or two people, while the director or choreographer would be staging a different number. But everybody's in all the dance numbers and everybody's in all the songs. So we kind of have to, it's all hands on deck all the time.
Wow.
The other thing that makes this show really interesting, I think, is that there aren't really any chorus numbers per se. There only are nine characters in the show. And so even when all of them are singing, it really is much more of a bunch of soloists combining forces, where each one is truly essential, and nobody ever kind of blends into the background.
Mm. And then by that same token, that means everybody really has to be a strong musician. I mean, you can't bury weaker musicians in a chorus where you have four altos singing a relatively easy alto part. There just aren't any easy parts here from the sounds of it.
That's right.
The alto part in particular is quite complicated.
Okay. With all due respect to altos everywhere. Nick, what is the accompaniment for this?
We are using a recording of a studio pit, and the recording has allowed us, through the company that provides it, to manipulate it as we have needed within pretty stringent boundaries, but we're able to manipulate it to adjust to our actors and our show and how we want those songs to go.
Right, and then you can send your actors off with that too, so they can do a lot of work on their own, I suppose, to really come to the perfect ensemble that you want.
Actually, the company that we're using provides a final product to us. We get an initial draft, a draft of the recording, and then we're able to request changes to that. But when they provide those changes, then that is in a centralized location. And in fact, we had to choose which device to put it onto to record, to play from.
So
that actually is one of the other challenges in the latter part of our rehearsal process is that the final version of the accompaniment the actors haven't had access to except in our general rehearsals.
Okay.
And so they have that time to get used to it, but that's it.
Wow, not much time at all. Well, I have several excerpts from the score that I thought might be fun to choose. And Jennifer, I have Magic Feet, Woe Is Me, and I Speak Six Languages, several of the kind of upbeat solos. Do you have a favorite you'd like us to hear?
I think I really like... I like all of those. I like both Woe Is Me and I Speak Six Languages because I feel like Magic Foot is actually is sort of a fantasy piece where the character is he's got this special ability to spell with his foot. He writes letters on the floor, and it's a very kind of showgirls kind of a number. Whereas Woe Is Me and I Speak Six Languages are both songs that really talk about the struggles that those characters are facing. So maybe you should play some of Woe Is Me.
Here is Woe Is Me. Good idea.
I'd just like to take one moment to thank my two fathers who've been so supportive of me and all of my endeavors. Thanks, Dad!
We hate losers.
No one likes a loser.
Which is why we discipline. God hates losers.
But he loves you.
Because losers do not know how to
win.
And we have faith in you, honey.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do.
Go get 'em.
I hope you can love me, America. I'm gunning for first prize. Here's why you should love me, America. My need I cannot overemphasize. I make myself crazy being what my dad hope I'll be. But what about me, Dad? What about me? Jesus Christ! What about me?
Practice your breathing, Logan.
Though I practice yoga, I don't breathe. I try not to disappoint, but still I disappoint the dads who my friends mock. Kids are mean, kids will talk. All my so-called friends roll their eyes. They're incredibly petty, because my dads are my dads, and all right, enough already.
Woe is me, woe is me.
Which is why I gotta win this spelling bee.
A little bit of the song Woe Is Me. And Jennifer, that's a great choice because, you know, not only is it a fun, high-energy song, but really, when you listen closely to the words, this is the really also troubling story of a adolescent under way too much pressure from well-meaning parents.
Yeah, I think I love the part of Logan and her two dads and the two actors who are playing her fathers. I feel like we've talked a lot, the Catherine who's playing Logan and Robbie who's playing her dad, her more competitive father. And the idea is that they're both kind of competitive by nature, but they've both gotten really caught up in preparing for the spelling bee. It's gotten really intense, and she's gotten really stressed and wound up. She's got a lot of tics. She does like these things with her fingers and stands on her tiptoes. And at the end, because this is a spoiler alert, I apologize, she is not the person who wins the spelling bee, although she makes it pretty far into the competition. When she spells her word wrong, she's been so wound up by what her dad has said to her. I mean, I don't know if you caught the line, God hates losers.
Yeah, right.
You're like, that's a terrible, terrifying thing to say to a child. And this is not in the script, although it doesn't in any way go against the text. We have her two dads sitting together in all throughout, too. They sit in the audience and interact with her. So when she loses, it's a very rough moment because, again, this child has been told, we hate losers. Her parents hate people who lose. God hates people who lose. And then she doesn't win. So that means her parents hate her and God hates her. And, you know, that's a lot for a 10-year-old to have to try and take in. So she kind of breaks down. And I feel like there's such evidence in this play of really terrible parenting. I felt like it was important to show some good parenting. So I have the dad on stage and you see his reaction to what he's done to his child. And he in the script, she usually goes to the comfort counselor who walks her off stage, and she's crying and the comfort counselor is taking care of her. But instead she runs to her dad, who then kneels before her and takes her face in his hands and very clearly, you know, you can't hear him, but he's very clearly saying, I am so proud of you. You are such a wonderful, you know, and she he realizes he wasn't the best dad, and then she jumps into his arms and he carries her off. And I to me, that's a very powerful moment.
And again, that's a moment not in the script. That's a moment you've injected into this.
Yeah. As a parent of a young child, I feel like I look at this show a little differently than I might have 3 years ago before my daughter was born. And one of the things I try very hard to do is to encourage my child to be the person she is and not who I want her to be, who I think she is. And I wanted to show a parent doing that in this script because I feel like a lot of the other characters in the play are having to realize they don't have to be the version of themselves that their parents want them to be. And I just wanted, you know, not all parents are the devil. Sometimes your parents can help.
Right. You know, it's as we're talking about how deep this show is and yet how hilariously funny, it occurs to me that there aren't all that many shows. I mean, lots of shows blend that to some extent, but the combination of those two really disparate elements is sort of uncommonly successful in this show, it seems to me.
And I think it can be difficult to navigate as a cast because most of Act One is very funny, and most of Act Two is very touching and difficult. There's still humor in Act Two, and there's still some hints of what's to come in Act One. But an audience, if you make an audience laugh all through Act One and then you take an intermission, they're exhausted from the effort of laughing. And, you know, they're with the show, they're happy, but it's difficult to then say, hey, we're going to take you someplace else. So it's tricky for the actors to try and keep the energy and the momentum and the right patterns so that they keep the audience with them.
Nick, the song with which we'll play out is the I Love You song, which is such an interesting sequence. I wonder if you can just say a word about, and Jennifer, chime in if you like, about this moment musically in the show and what it sort of means in the story.
This is probably the most well-known song from this musical. I hear it most often in isolation. It's by far the most beautiful. It's clearly the most serious of intent. There's nothing much comical about the I Love You song. It's the moment when one of the final spellers goes into her dream world, which involves simply the presence of her parents, who are otherwise. Her mother is on a pilgrimage in India and not communicating with her during that time.
Mother's away for 9 months and not talking to her.
Wow.
And so her father is absent in as much as he seems to be working all the time and trying to keep the household together, but not physically there with her. And so the I Love You song involves all three of those characters singing together. And it's another moment where I think the depth and the serious emotion of this show comes through, and I think it points to how clever it's so clever to use children as all of the prime characters, because children are so bound up in other people's lives They bring with them that depth just by nature of their dependence on a parent or someone to watch over them and care for them. And so the I Love You song shows that as much as any other, really poignantly, because Olive begins singing alone. Olive is the speller, the child in the song. And she begins singing alone, and then the parents join her in the song, and they sing this beautiful trio together, and then they kind of end still singing together, but moving away. The parents are kind of fading into the distance again, and we realize Olive is pretty alone. Even with the two parents that love her, that tell her all of the things that you want to hear from parents, there's this absence and pain.
The thing about the I Love You song, and again, this is late in the show, so we've seen a lot of kids having flashbacks, a lot of kids, you see what their home life is like. And so when Olive gets the word chimerical and the music begins while she is waiting to spell her word, the first time I heard this song, again, listening to the whole show, you start hearing her mom singing about how much she loves you and how they couldn't be prouder and all of these things. You're so beautiful when you were born. We always knew you were a winner. Dad comes in. He starts singing the same things. My reaction was, oh, good. Okay, so this character does have parents, even though, you know, one's out of the country and one is late for the spelling bee. She does have parents who love her. But when you get to the end of the song, She spells out the word chimerical and reminds us of the definition: highly unreal, highly unlikely, magical fantasy. These are not her parents. These are the parents she wishes she had, that she doesn't have anybody in her life telling her how much she loves them. And I for a decade, pretty much could not listen to this song without crying. It's so heartbreaking to me that there's this beautiful child who is not being cared for.
Right. And, of course, what's ultimately the most heartbreaking about what you just described so well is that not only in the context of this fictional show, but you think about out in the real world.
Well, all of these kids are representing kids from out in the real world. I feel like I'd love for lots of parents and future parents to come see this show just sort of as a reminder, hey, be kind to your children.
No kidding. Be patient
and loving.
Absolutely. So we're going to listen to a bit of the I Love You song to finish out part one of today's morning show. We want to remind people that Putnam County Spelling Bee opens this weekend and it runs the next two weekends in which theater?
This is in our Black Box Theater at the Rita Talent Pick and Region Center.
Oh, it's such a neat space.
For the performing arts. It's an amazing space. This is my third show that I've directed at Parkside, and this is the first time I've been in this space, and I love it.
Perfect. If people want more information about tickets,
They can go to the UW Parkside Theater page, or they can contact our box office.
Very good. So you can go to the website, which is uwp.edu. Jennifer Sassaman, the director of the show, Nick Brudian, the music director for the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. My thanks to both of you for joining me. I was glad to hear that last night went so very well. It sounds like you have a terrific show on your hands, and we hope a lot of people will seek it out. And here's a bit of the I Love You song to finish out part one of today's morning show on WGTD.
Chimerical.
May I have a definition?
It means unreal, imaginary, visionary, wildly fanciful, highly unrealistic.
If I go to Washington, if I go to Washington, who will be my chaperone? We always knew you were a winner. We saw it when you smiled. Start from the beginning when you were a beginner. You were the perfect child. We always knew you were a champion. Your sadness filled my room. Should feel my gloom. Blame it on me. Blame it on your daddily and mammily. 'Cause depression runs in our family. I love you. I love you. I love everything about you, dear. Agreed. Tell me what you're learning, Ma.
Shanti and Om. I think he takes out on me what he wants to take out on you. Mama, 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 how I wish you were home. How I wish you were home. How I wish.
The beautiful moment from Putnam County Spelling Bee, the I Love You song. And again, that show opens this weekend with performances this weekend and the next at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. The time is 8:46. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two. Today on The Morning Show, we tackle the topic of eating disorders among young people. And it is a phenomenon which we especially see among adolescent girls. A new book has been written and published by Da Capo Press called Just a Little Too Thin, How to Pull Your Child Back from the Brink of an Eating Disorder. One of the authors is Dr. Michael Strober, who is a well-known authority on the topic, professor of psychiatry at the David Geffen School of Medicine, and director of the Eating Disorders Program and Adolescent Mood Disorders Program at a hospital at UCLA, and editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Eating Disorders. Dr. Strober, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
One matter which I think we need to address right off the bat, and then we'll get into the heart and soul of your discussion. We are discussing something which flies in the face of in what is, in some respects at least, the completely opposite phenomenon, and that is teenage obesity among both young men and young women. Just talk for a moment about how we can see these two things going on simultaneously, and if it's important to be aware of anything as we tackle this particular side of it.
You're very right. The problems of excessive dieting occur alongside the equally significant and not completely unrelated problem of increases in the prevalence of obesity, particularly in young people. We know that the rate of obesity in the general population has increased, and we know that it has increased among children as well. And at the same time, we have a continuing pressure promulgated by very powerful media influences to diet, to lose weight, to transform one's appearance. And these pressures exist side by side in our society today, and teenagers have a difficult time of reconciling these two pressures. They're becoming increasingly heavy, and at the same time, there is the ever-present pressure to be thinner.
One of the points which I've heard made is that because these kind of eating disorders like anorexia nervosa at least primarily affect young Caucasian women of middle class or upper class background, that I've heard the charge leveled that we pay more attention to this disorder than is perhaps warranted by the numbers because of who it occurs to. Or who it happens to. I can kind of guess what your response might be to those kind of concerns. Have you heard that raised yourself?
I have, and I can appreciate the sentiment involved. The fact is that we are seeing eating disorders develop across a wide spectrum of the socioeconomic and racial ethnic population. We do know that eating disorders exist in minority populations as well. They appear to be becoming more common in the lower social classes. They are not blind or indifferent to race, ethnicity, or social background is the point. But I understand the sensitivity and the sentiment. The fact is that the eating disorders affect roughly 5% of the female population. That's an enormous number. It is considered a public health problem, and to the degree that the National Institute of Health and the National Institute of Mental Health consider this a really unstudied area. We know relatively little about the complexity of these problems, even though much has been learned in the last decade. So we have increasing knowledge and many, many unanswered questions. And
one of the things which, of course, is such a curious thing is the fact that this affects so many more adolescent girls versus boys. One clue to maybe one reason why is in your book when you talk about the profound ways in which the female body changes in puberty. And, of course, the male body changes as well. But there are some ways in which the female body changes that maybe help us understand why then this phenomenon of the eating disorder might be so much more prevalent among females.
Yes, there are undoubtedly a number of reasons why eating disorders and weight and shape preoccupation are more prominent in females than in males. And there are developmental issues, there are social issues, there are also very significant biological and genetic factors that come into play. All of these things sort of merge together to create a distinctly greater degree of dissatisfaction in females than in males. And what you're saying is absolutely true, that body physiology in females is not analogous to body physiology in males. And what we do know about puberty in females is that the accumulation of body fat is greater than in males, and this accounts for the rounding of the figure in females and the tendency for males to put on more muscle.
One thing that is an essential point to make almost right off the bat here is that this book, which you really have crafted for the sake of parents or other caregivers, is that there is a problem with pouncing too quickly or too aggressively if you start to have some concerns about your adolescent. And I like how you phrase it at one point in saying that part of this book is all about sorting out the difference between a problem and a pathology. Explain mm-hmm. that just a little further.
Yes, most dieting behavior is normative in teenagers. We know that roughly 50 to 60% of teenage girls will diet at any one point in time. We know that body dissatisfaction is common in females. We know that females tend to distort their body size. So most diets are nothing more than that, an understandable and normative attempt to lose weight. And diets will arise even in teenagers who are within the normal weight range. On the other hand, we do know that these things can progress. We know that there are psychological factors that are associated with the progression of dieting behavior into more serious eating disorders. We've been able to identify some of the specific risk factors involved. So the book is an attempt to give parents background, to educate them as to the risk factors that are known to be associated with the progression to more serious concerns, and to give parents a sense of what the warning indicators are so that parents can sort of navigate through this very, very complex area and know when there is reason to be concerned and what to do about it and when there is not reason to be concerned.
Hmm. Ahead of the specific discussions about what typically occurs when an eating disorder begins to emerge, you talk about the importance of media. And a lot of this has been extensively discussed, but you do, I think, an especially good job of it in your book, especially at one point when you mention that the media tends to objectify the body. That that picture on the cover of People magazine or whatever it might be objectifies the body, separates the body from the rest of the person. And by having entire articles and photo spreads devoted to just actresses and their bodies, for instance, I mean, quite apart from their character, we're doing something which, in a very sinister, pervasive way, really changes the way young people think about, in terms of what's important.
I agree completely. That is precisely what the media does. It gives very short shrift to character, to morality, to psychology, to emotionality. It really objectifies the human condition in a way that is very insidious and unhealthy. And parents need to become more understanding of what the media does and the impact that it has on teenagers. And the books recommends a number of things for parents to do to help become more media savvy, more media literate, and how to discuss this with their teenagers. Not that that is an easy thing to do. Teenagers are highly influenced by this, but parents need to help their teenagers understand how the media contributes to short-sightedness and nearsightedness.
You save some of your harshest rhetoric for the new makeover programs on television, which you cite as some of the most serious offenders in all of this.
Yes, it's really just so distressing and disturbing, and it, let us not understate the impact that this has on teenagers who are relying on plastic surgery now to an increasing degree in ways that are unprecedented. You know, the notion is that if you have something that's wrong, you can fix it, which I think draws attention away from so many of the other important, crucial aspects of a person's character, and again, this sort of short-sightedness and nearsightedness that comes from objectifying the body, and then promulgating the notion that anything that you want can be fixed.
Hmm. We should mention that also with the background that you give here, you talk about various types of families and the family dynamic, and also a whole chapter called The Emotional Undercurrent, in which you remind us that we really should not talk about eating disorders in isolation. When we start getting into the heart of your book and the ways in which parents need to be alert to some changes, you talk about some stages. And for many adolescent girls, we're talking about stage one being what you call the innocent dieter, where a young person might be sensibly concerned about their weight, just as all of us to some extent need to be. And you say that it's important for parents to have a clear understanding of what healthy eating is and what a healthy concern about one's weight, what that looks like, what that feels like.
Yes, it's very important because, as you mentioned earlier, parents, I think, now increasingly are very concerned and worried. They understand about eating disorders, and to the extent that they understand it and they're sensitized to it, and they may be very, very aware of their sort of the emotional side of their child's development, it's not unusual for parents to panic when their child expresses a wish to lose weight and starts a diet. And most diets are going to be relatively short-lived or sensible. They have a purpose. They're rational. And we thought it was important for parents just to have a very sort of global profile of what a reasonable, healthy diet will look like.
Michael Strober is the author of Just a Little Too Thin, How to Pull Your Child Back from the Brink of an Eating Disorder, published by Da Capo Press. Tomorrow on the morning show, we look at the great Benny Goodman with Michael Goodbar, who is helping to organize and preside over a concert about Benny Goodman, which is happening Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church as part of their Fine Arts at First series. Also, we will meet one of the members of the women's group Libana, which is performing this weekend at Prairie School. On Friday, the first of a series of interviews around the topic of Orson Welles, the legendary filmmaker. His 100th birthday is coming up next week on this, actually a week from today, on Wednesday, the 6th of May, which is the kickoff for a whole series of exciting events here in Kenosha, where Orson Welles was born. On Friday, you'll hear from film historian Joseph McBride.